You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, Senior Editor.
Susie Evans, I'm the Managing Editor.
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And we've got a great show today. Our special guest interview is with NEA Chairman Jane Chu. Chairperson Jane Chu, who we talked to at our TCG conference over the weekend in Cleveland, and that's our first topic will be, you know, debriefing on the conference in general. It's a gathering of theater professionals from all over the country every year in a different city. We'll also talk a little about the Kilroys, a gang, a self-identified gang, that's what they call themselves, of playwrights and producers based in LA who. This is their second annual list of plays by underproduced or unproduced female playwrights. And then we'll go to Jane Chu and come back for recommendations. Let's start with conference. So this was your first conference, and you're going to also be writing a big wrap-up piece for us. You're in the midst of that, doing that now. What was some impressions and takeaways for you as a first-time conference goer?
Well, I had a really good time. I thought Cleveland was a really fun town. That was kind of a big surprise. I know we made a lot of jokes at the conference about Cleveland, really, but there was a lot of cool stuff going on in Cleveland, so I thought that was fun. As far as the conference goes, yeah, it's a busy 3 days. I mean, there's lots of people, lots of running around. I'm told that there's usually different setups. This year it was set up in the theaters at a theater complex called Playhouse Square in Cleveland, which is, according to them, the second largest theater complex in the country.
So after Lincoln Center, probably.
After Lincoln Center, yeah. Broadway, yeah.
Eight
not like the
venues.
Most theaters in the city, but the actual complex. And there are a lot of spaces in that complex, so I don't believe them.
Yeah.
I thought it was good. And, you know, as I'm thinking about the article and thinking about writing the article, I'm kind of identifying trends from the actual conference. I think the biggest theme that intersected with every trend they did was the At the Intersections workshops, which they did for affinity groups. This year they focused on disability as an element of TCG's Equality, Diversity, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of representatives of the disability cohort, but there were affinity groups for everyone from gender to class to profession to ethnicity, and that was definitely focused on in both the affinity groups, which were met throughout, and also at different sessions. Another big trend that I thought about at the conference this year was the idea of succession. A lot of theater companies are going through leadership changes right now. I went to a session where David Hawkinson and David Schmitz from Steppenwolf talked about their transition.
Right.
And that, of course, intersects with the whole ED&I initiative because, you know, when you're thinking about who's going to come onto your company and who's going to be leadership, we want to create opportunities for, you know, anyone who has the qualifications, whether it be from the theater field, whether it not be opening the doors to people to come in and lead and making sure you find the right person for your company. And the other big trend I noticed was the trend of both audience engagement and audience development. I went to our TCG's Audience Revolution
seminar, right.
Which was really cool. That was more about audience development, finding different communities in your area to come to the theater, and then retaining them, which I thought was interesting. Both whether you're doing a show that's targeted at a Latino, Latina crowd, and making sure that you get them invested in all the shows in your season and not just the one show that might speak to them.
Yeah.
I thought was cool. One guy in that session talked about how, I don't remember what show it was that they did, but part of it was in Farsi, so they had a big Persian community come out for it, and then after that show was over, they had a member of the Persian community join the board, so they were able to retain. So I thought that was an interesting strategy. Anyway, those were kind of the three trends I identified in the majority of what I went through, but you guys were in different sessions, so what did you see?
I mean, I definitely saw similar trends. Our keynote speakers, we should know, were Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, and then there was a keynote sort of discussion with Lisa Krohn, playwright, Fun Home, and Well.
Tony Winning, playwright.
Right,
two-time
Tony, we can say two-time Tony Winning, Tony Winner, Lisa Krohn, with Oscar Eustace. Really just sort of a taste of what she has to say, but it was interesting. I went to see David Greenspan do his Gertrude Stein lecture piece as my theatrical, the only theatrical outing I could take in. Did anybody see any theater while they were in?
Yeah, Deepa and I saw Exact Change, which is a one-woman show by a transgender theater critic.
Christine Howie.
Christine Howie,
yeah.
From Cleveland. Really compelling story.
originally ran at the Cleveland Public Theater, and then they did a second run at Playhouse Square in the Helen space, which is a black box space, and it was basically about her transitioning and small moments in her life that made her feel very out of place, and how being a when she was a man and being a father, like she was unable to. That was the most powerful moment for me. Like she was unable to hug her daughter because she just never felt like quite whole in her own skin. So that was so. There are some powerful moments within that particular
show.
Compelling
because she was older.
Yeah.
She was in her late 60s, and so
yeah,
she had experienced this at a young age, and it was something that wasn't talked about in the 40s and fifties when she was born. So
when did she make her transition? Was
in the 90s.
Okay,
so
late
40s,
90s.
Probably, right?
But
yeah.
She talked a lot about how she knew the day she was born, like
she wanted to be a girl or something wasn't quite right.
Did theater criticism figure into this at all?
No, not so much theater criticism, though she did moonlight a lot as an actor back in the day too. So it wasn't just coming
moonlight
out
as an actor and a theater critic.
I have no idea. We should have asked her that at the talk back.
That's true.
Yeah.
I think I tried to make a play in the story. I forget the fellow's name, who wrote a story for us about her show, a preview piece, about which divide was more, fraught, the one between artist and critic or the one between man and woman. But, obviously.
They're both fraught.
Speaking of which, you can look for in our July-August issue a piece by David Cody of Time Out about the critics who are artists and vice versa.
Yeah.
Not to get off topic, but Christine's one of the sources for that story, too.
Yeah. And one session that I went to that really stuck with me is this year they did something a little bit different at the conference. And every year there's different sessions, different breakouts of little workshops aligning with different topics. But this year they did something different in that they had, on Friday, they had like one long skills building section where instead of doing like an hour and a half session, you do like 2 hour and a half sessions. Technically you're supposed to go to both of them. Not everyone followed the rules, but I went to two sessions that were about unconscious biases and kind of pinpointing it and talking about like the societal, I guess, the causes of it and what they articulated for me, which I never really thought about in this way, which makes a lot of sense, was the fact that unconscious bias is a result of, like, they positioned racism as like this groundwater effect, where instead of there's a poisoned lake and like all the dead fishes are all the byproducts of racism, and instead of like taking out the dead fish and trying and redraining the lake, like we should fix like what is underneath it, like the groundwater. So the groundwater of racism is like the societal structures that have been put in place to kind of prioritize the viewpoint or the privilege of one certain group of people. And so racism isn't so much like individual acts of cruelty. It's
right.
It's endemic societal institutional.
Systemic.
So that was really interesting and how, we all have biases and which have been ingrained in us because of the society that we grew up in. And then they show this video that made a few people in my session like break down. And it was this video of these black children, these young black kids and white kids, and they gave them two dolls, a black doll and a white doll. And they asked each kid, which doll is the nice doll? Which doll is the pretty doll?
Right.
And like 9 times out of 10, both black and white kids picked the white doll. And so.
For the positive attributes.
Yes. As, as a nice one, as a pretty one, as the one that you would like to be.
Right.
And black is the bad doll. And so you see that when you're a kid, and then when you grow up and you see like that doll that you associate with bad become an actual person,
right.
That kind of, like, it sticks with you.
It's internal.
Yeah.
It sounds like they're showing that groups that are oppressed or underrepresented are internalized.
Yeah, like we all internalize the biases,
mm-hmm.
which, prioritize one particular group of people because we grew up in a society that
right.
puts those people in positions of power. So that was interesting.
I wasn't able to stick with a morning and afternoon session. I went to Michael Rhodes' piece about civic practice. He did some great mapping exercises where he had people say where they're from. It was like a musical chairs thing where one chair was missing, and you had to someone would get up and say, "Where I'm from, there are lots of guns," and everyone who that applied to had to get up and find another chair. And then if whoever was left, anyway, it was interesting to see, you know, some of the commonalities. And this was sort of the basis of some of the civic practice work that he does with Sojourn Theater and other theaters. I didn't go back to the afternoon one, partly because I encourage our readers to check this out. We were trying to cover the conference while we were there. So Deep, myself, all four of us, Allison, our editorial assistant, and Susie, we all covered one of the plenaries. And so I was writing up the Lisa Crone one, which is, I had to spend my, some time. I don't know how we all did it.
Yeah.
We forgot one plenary speaker, Dave Say of StoryCorps was the other plenary speaker.
Yes, the plenary speaker, I'm sorry, yeah, and that's the one Allison wrote.
And the last one as well with the round table of Mina Marita, of Crowded Fire.
Michael Kahn, Greg Reward, those are artistic directors.
Nigel
Smith. That was a good way to close it.
Game-changing artistic directors. That was the theme. Well, Game Change was the theme of interesting new practices.
But I thought Dave Say was one of the surprises. I don't know. You didn't see that one or not.
I didn't see it, unfortunately.
It had the entire audience weeping. Like, it was very emotionally affecting. The whole conference had a theme of emotionality.
There was a lot of that.
Really,
I did notice.
A lot of tears.
I love this line in yours about how there was time for Q&A, and we were like, no, just show us more of your story core of greatest hits of people telling their stories.
There was a woman who just shouted for Q&A, and she was like, play us more stories.
Yeah.
Play us a happy one.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about death.
They were just really, he curated it really well. I mean, the way he chose the stories and the order in which he played them, it was very, I mean, technically the first one he played was happy, but it was also heartbreaking. It was about this old couple that just loved each other. And they recorded their final one, like, right before he, like, passed away.
Yeah.
But he still
Here's a question I had for you, Rob. I mean, I've been to four of these, and you've been to six of these, and so
five. But
So how do you think this one's lined up?
You know, it's hard to
say. In comparison to the rest of them,
my very first one was in Chicago, and it was so amazing. It was all in one. It was in a hotel, so there was no. I mean, you could sometimes get lost on which floor you're on, but you didn't have to. And there was there was a couple events at the Goodman, so that was a little bit of a walk from the hotel, Palmer House. And that was such a seminal one for me. And there's so many great artists coming through Chicago, and I had so many story ideas came out of that. And I was also the roving reporter, so I was able just to go wherever I wanted. That was kind of special for me, partly because of that aspect. It's hard. The thing about the conference that's great and also hard about it is that they change up the way it's done. And, of course, in a new city, there's new layouts to figure out. So you never settle into a routine. Even though a lot of some of the similar themes and themes, definitely similar faces show up, I find it actually it's just as challenging every year. I guess is what I'm saying. It's always fun. It's always interesting, but it's always challenging to sort of balance. Like, oh, I want to catch up with that person. Oh, I got to get their contact. The networking part of it, which is part of what we're doing, as well as the coverage, and then also just trying to have a good time and see the city. I really did not get to explore Cleveland as much as I would like.
Yeah, well, except for Cleveland Public Theater,
Theater.
Gave like one of the best opening night parties that we've had.
Yeah, they did a party called Pandemonium, and it was at their space, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, they do this annual gala called Pandemonium, and what they basically do is it's like a carnival of like games and performances,
right.
And they occupy two churches side by side, and so they do it in both churches, the gala Pandemonium, and I think they raise six figures every year. And then the TCG opening night party, it was only in one of their spaces, but it still comfortably housed like 800 theater people and 12 different performances throughout the night.
And lots of good food, Mitchell's ice cream, some pizza.
Happy dogs, brunettes.
Donuts with beer in it.
Pink elephants to dance through the crowd.
And
it's not just the drink talk.
Mice dance through the crowd.
The mice, yeah.
Yeah, we danced with mice, danced with pink elephants, danced with...
So yeah, that was a memorable event. We got all kind of buses to go there because it was not nearby downtown Cleveland.
It's like college. It's a party bus.
So yeah, we have a TCG, hashtag TCG15 page on our website. You can read about that. I just put up a piece about Rodessa Jones, who took the Theater Practitioner Award.
She gave a great speech.
Very quotable speech. Cultural Odyssey in San Francisco. And so I hope there's a quotable Q&A I did with her. She's got great stories. I didn't realize when I spoke to her that she's from the Jones family, as in Bill T. Jones is her brother. And as a brother named Azel, who wrote a play. So she comes from a fascinating theatrical family. And there'll be another, this podcast should be part of that, as will your story, that'll be next week.
Yeah, I'm in early.
So,
yeah, and if you want to watch some of the plenaries, which it was like the big gathering with all 800 theater people, and some
actually,
of the sessions,
the
plenaries, it's all on HowlRound.
Yeah,
a lot of sessions were on HowlRound.
I went to HowlRound.
HowlRound.com/TV.
Yeah, they were there. It was great what they do. So yeah, if you want to move on to speaking about conscious bias, the Kilroys put out another list of
good plays.
Plays, I mean, it's inspired by something called The Blacklist. I think his name's Franklin Leonard. He's a Hollywood screenwriter or a development person who put together a list. Every person who works in the literary department at a studio or at a theater has a list of favorite plays, the plays that got away, plays they couldn't convince their theater to do or that no one will, or to do again, or plays that they love that's in their back. And it's sort of inspired by that. He puts out a list every year of the Hollywood's favorite unproduced screenplays. And the idea of the Kilroy's list was partly that, but also all these plays by that aren't produced by women. And it's sort of to counteract the idea that, this is just the best, we just put on the best plays, right? There must be fewer good plays by women. And a lot of people work in literary departments, not just women. People who work in the theater industry know that's not true. They have stacks of plays by women, stacks of plays by men. And because of, in part, unconscious bias, and other structural issues, there are fewer plays each year, our TCG list tells us. There are, you know, it's anywhere from 80-20, 70-30, depending on how you count it, ratio of plays by women versus plays by men. So the list is just a way to sort of create their own, quote, pipeline, to say, when people say, oh, where are the plays by women? Well, here's a bunch of great plays by women. Last year it was 47, this year 53. They do it by questioning groups of nominators who are in the industry, producers, development people, literary departments, to say, what are the plays that you would love to see? I mean, last year, Sheila Callahan pointed out, she's one of the Kilroys, she pointed out that it was a slightly more mainstream list, in part because it was a smaller group of nominators. People didn't know what this was. They didn't all respond. And when they went to people, this is a pent-up demand of people saying they pulled out all the plays that they wanted to do. And a lot of those include sort of more mainstream plays. This year, they made an effort to reach out with more geographic and cultural diversity, class diversity across the country so that their list... Because they don't put their finger on the scales for the nominations. They just take the nominations and tally them. But they picked nominators that had a wider range of class and aesthetic as well. This is something interesting Joy Meads pointed out. This is unconscious bias. I didn't really get to include this in my story online.
How many people did you talk to for your story?
They put me on a conference call with 4 people.
Jesus Christ.
So, yeah, it was hard to tell their voices apart. But I think
you're
going
to have to do that again when we go to Jenna Berry's story.
And I think I quoted them all correctly. But Joy said... pointed out that one of the challenges is, is aesthetic diversity, and that what she sees a trend. She didn't name any particular place, but I think I know what she's talking about. That there's often people will say, oh, let's make room for a play by a woman, like not any particular play or any particular woman, just like a play by a woman. And that tends less often to be like the edgy, crazy, interesting piece. It tends to be a play about women or a play about, they're looking for a play that deals with those themes that they consider women's themes, as opposed to just works of genius or works of magic or works of imagination. That experimental work tends to less be associated with women just because of an unconscious bias that, oh yeah, there's some great women playwrights who write women plays. And then there's the geniuses who change our perceptions of theater.
It's like that bias.
Can a woman play not change your perception?
Oh, no, exactly. Yeah. She's saying that conscious bias. It reminded me of what Lisa Crone said. I love what she said in her thing.
Yeah.
She said, she sort of chafes at the idea that we need more plays that look like us and then tell our stories. She was saying that's not quite right. What we need is a bunch of diverse artists telling the story of the world. The idea that an artist from any background can get up there and create the world on stage,
mm-hmm.
their world, a world that looks like ours, doesn't look like ours, whatever. And so it's not so much about filling a slot like, oh, here's our Asian play, here's our woman play, here's our... It's more like we need to get as many diverse artists in there and then let them write whatever they want and recognize their genius in whatever...
Yeah.
And
the universality of all themes. I mean,
yeah.
Specificity yields universality.
Yeah, but there's also that bias of, and it's endemic in Hollywood and in literature, of women, the stories written by women are only pertinent to women, whereas stories written by men
right.
are universal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's
and especially if you're people of a person of color as well. Like, you Asian American playwright, right? It's like, it's an Asian American story, whereas... As opposed to being
exactly,
like a story about a family that just happens to be Asian American.
Right, right. This A-Ray Pamatma play,
mm-hmm.
who shoot things and hit them, just got some reviews in Boston, I think it was, that were similarly problematic among them. I don't forget the critic. It wasn't the Boston Globe critic, but who said something like, you know, it's interesting the characters are Filipino. They didn't talk very much about that in the play. And they you know, interesting they don't have race problems at school. Like, he was basically saying, it's a place with Asians in it. They didn't talk about being Asian at all. Like, well, okay. You know, that's just...
I'm going to have to go smack somebody.
Right. It's yeah, I...
That's awful. Someone
yeah.
really wrote that?
Yeah. I
essentially,
think-
Howard Stern pointed out in his column, part of this is it's a generational way of thinking. Mark Valdez, I spoke to, who's putting together an event at Mixed Blood called DJ Latinidad, I think it's called. It's an event next spring. And they solicited work from Latino writers. And apparently Jack Ruler, the you know, sort of visionary leader of Mixed Blood, he was at first worried about the plays. They weren't up on Latino themes. And he thought, is this what we want? And Mark said, of course this is what we want. We're just saying this is Latino writers. They're writing about whatever they want. They can write about identity politics, or they can just write a great play that, you know, that everyone can that is about whatever. That's about the world. That's about what's on their mind. And I think that Lisa's point resonated with me very strongly. What I think about something like Angels in America, for instance. Yes, it's a gay play, but that is a play in which it has no limits in its imagination and what it's about. It is a play about the world, literally, like the whole world, heaven, earth. The whole world is contained within this gay... It reminds me, August Wilson also would always say, he felt like the entire human experience could be contained within the African-American experience. He didn't have to make his plays universal or have them be about... politics. They were all that, you know, they were self-contained, the worlds he created. So it's a resonant idea. I think what the Kilroys are doing...
There's some mainstream names on that list. Like some.
Well, that's what's interesting is that there are names of veteran playwrights on there. So,
but like the thing that I find interesting about the Kilroys list, and maybe I question a little bit, is that the plays can have been produced once; they just need to be like Sweats on there by Lynn Nottage, and that's going to be at OSF. And like You Got Older by Claire Behrens on there, that got produced here. So like these are plays that have been produced. Just only
the rule
one.
Is that they can have
only one production.
Have had only one production. Now, what's interesting about Sweat is that I don't know when they picked this list or when the final list was made.
Production, yeah,
but. Sweat has been announced for two productions already, Arena Stage and OSF, and it's almost definitely going to be in New York next summer.
Yeah.
Before the election, which is something Lynn wants to happen. Because it's political. I think the idea is that if they made it just unproduced plays, I've never really quite teased this out with them, that would be a different list if we're just unproduced plays. But they want to, I think they want to include...
They want to encourage second production.
Yeah.
Right, and I think they talk about canonization. Which plays are not just produced once because it's a nice thing to do, but which plays become part of the theatrical literature? One thing, I don't know if I had a chance to include this. I think I did include this in the story, that among the people who have requested the list of plays is our college students and courses. Someone's teaching a whole course on these plays. And what's moving about that is that you think young people coming up will have just a different picture of what the canon is, of what are the great plays... Who are the great writers? And just bit by bit, you can chip away at this idea that, oh, the great writers are men, and then there's some women writers too, right? So I think that's important work.
And also when it comes to the classics, there aren't that very many women represented, so where else are young players coming up going to find women but in new plays?
Right. I think there's also an effort to uncover and recover some works. But yeah, there's just because of structural biases that go back centuries, there are fewer plays that come to us from female playwrights.
Afro-Ben in our canon would be nice.
It's only a couple of plays to do. But anyway, yeah. Susan Jonas, it's on Facebook. I don't know if we should... She put together an amazing list of like her alternative female canon. I should look into trying to publish that or talk to her more about it, because some people have done the work. Jill Dolan, I'm sure, has done some work on this, of what the female canon would look like going back centuries. So Kilroy's is one part of a larger movement. Let's go to Jane Chu, the second chairperson of the National Endowment of the Arts, Jane, that I know. Jane Alexander was the one when I was coming up. But Jane Chu, tell me about
that. Yeah, Jane Chu is the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, and she came and spoke at our conference in Cleveland, and we were lucky enough to get some time to sit down with her for the podcast. She's very lovely, very nice. We spoke a lot about funding for the arts, both in schools and in programs, and for specifically for theaters as opposed to specialty programs. The bill for the NEA budget is in appropriations with Congress right now, so we talked about that. She said she thinks it's probably going to hold steady as a budget, which is encouraging.
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, theater, her own, you know, a little bit about her own personal artistic background. She's from the classical music and the visual art world, but she likes theater, and yeah, it was a fun conversation, so I hope you enjoyed it.
Sounds good. Over to her.
This is Susie Evans, managing editor of American Theater Magazine. We're here with American Theater's Offscript with chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Jane Chu, who's visiting us at the TCG conference in Cleveland. Thank you so much for taking time to chat with us, Chairman Chu.
Thanks for letting me join you.
Chairman Chu just made some wonderful remarks for our conference about her own experience with the arts and her own work at the NEA. And I'm curious, just want to start off by talking about, you mentioned the importance of audience members seeing themselves on stage and really identifying with the arts. I was wondering if there was a formative or a memorable theatrical experience that you've had that you can share with us.
They've all been great because one of the things that a theater does so well is it allows you to have a visceral experience. So you can see on stage, looking at the stories, which may be your own, the human condition, or they may be stories of others, or they may be stories of other topics. But it's always, on some level, both an intellectual experience as well as an emotional feeling experience. So that combination is such a great way to walk out. We who are lifelong learners walk out having known more and experienced more. I've loved theater myself personally, and I've been even growing up as a child, mostly in the musical theater side. So choruses and various parts, and I even remember playing Bloody Mary in South Pacific when I was in high school for my senior play. So it was all fun.
That's amazing. I'm a big fan of the musical South Pacific. They did a great revival of it on Broadway a few years ago.
I saw that, and it was wonderful.
It was so wonderful. Another thing is, you have a storied career in the arts before joining the NEA, but one of your notches on your resume is the CEO of the Kauffman Center for the Arts in Kansas City. And what is something that you learned during the process of building that center that you think can apply to other arts leaders in the country?
Well, one of the things that was so great about being part of the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in Kansas City, because I had the opportunity to be involved from groundbreaking to opening and then a few years after that before I came to the National Endowment for the Arts. And the same major lesson that I learned at the Kauffman Center is the same concept that I am learning at the National Endowment for the Arts. And that is, it's a time in our lives where we have an opportunity to bring together disparate pieces of information that don't seemingly link to each other at first glance, but really are part of it. So, for example, at the Kauffman Center, we dealt with drywallers and oboe players and everybody in between. There were multiple constituents, everything from the board to the donors to the general public, and everybody really had an opportunity to have ownership in this building and feel like it was theirs. And at the National Endowment for the Arts, it's similar. One day I'm talking to artists, and the next day I'm talking to people who facilitate the arts, but then we all have members of Congress, and we have all the general public, and what about the children and arts education? So there are multiple ways, and I think leadership is moving in that direction, where it used to be leadership was only involving people who knew pieces of information at a very deep level, and that's really impressive. But now we're also expanding to have leadership be the ability to synthesize different parts and pieces that don't always relate to each other. So these opportunities, Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts and National Endowment for the Arts, are great opportunities for me to be able to know how to synthesize these pieces.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And another thing that was so important to your work there is your amazing fundraising ability. And I'm curious if you have any advice you could give theaters or arts organizations to boost their fundraising efforts.
Well, in the big picture, and certainly fundraising takes teams and lots of different people, so it's never just one person by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But in the big picture, it's really important to listen. It's funny because people think I need to do a dog and pony show that really represents what I'm trying to tell them about my organization. And it is absolutely important to let the people know about, potential donors know about, what's going on in the organization. But it isn't about talking at anybody. It's about listening to them and finding those connections that mean the most to them. And the arts do that great. And in fundraising, that's when you really establish a good, deep relationship and a long-term sustainable connection.
Yeah. And how does your fundraising background help you in educating members of Congress about allocating funds to the arts?
Well, it is all about communication and education. We're not an advocacy organization, and we don't formally advocate. But it is an opportunity to listen to members of Congress, just as I said in terms about fundraising, and help us understand what is not only meaningful to them, but the conditions in which they are operating, and also to educate them about. And the main piece that that is important to me to make sure people understand is that the arts aren't off in some silo. They're not off by themselves. They're not just a frill, but we see them infusing our everyday lives in so many different ways, from the healing arts program that we have with our military service members who are affected by post-traumatic stress disorder and other psychological health conditions, to the ways they transform schools and kids, and they're an equalizer for families such as mine, which didn't use English as its first language. There's so many different opportunities that we want people to help understand the transformational power of the arts.
Definitely. And you speak a lot about, in your remarks that you made this morning at the conference, about the importance of social engagement programs in the arts, and many theaters and arts organizations are already working to help serve underserved communities and populations. How do you see your role specifically at the NEA in helping facilitate more work like this?
Well, certainly that is when the citizen panels meet to review grant proposals that come in, and that is certainly the mission also of the National Endowment for the Arts, is to make sure that all Americans have the opportunity to experience the arts and the role of the National Endowment for the Arts, which is just to elevate, nurture, and sustain that creativity and those opportunities. So our role is to be able to help people have those opportunities, and our citizen panels, our National Council on the Arts, they all even review proposals based on excellence and merit that when they come in, people are understanding how they can reach out to all Americans.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And one of the things I love about just your personal story is what you shared in your remarks is about your parents coming over from China, and you were raised in Arkansas, born in Oklahoma. I'm curious what your thoughts are. It's a big focus of the conference this year. What do you think is the importance of expanding diversity on our stage and in our theaters?
Well, it's very important for several reasons. And I love the name of the TCG conference this year. It's a game change because really it is. We're in the middle of a shifting transition and the games are changing.
Mm-hmm.
So good for you. Good for TCG for thinking about this. Here's an example, though, of how quickly the pace is changing. If I look at the demographics report of demographer William Fry at Brookings Institution, he is projecting that the following, by 2020, so that's 5 years from now, the population in America that is 18 and under will be minority majority. And this is based on shifting racial demographics. By 2040, the population of age 30 and under will be minority-majority. And then by 2050, certainly by 2060, there will be no racial minorities. That is while there have been shifting demographics, the pace is quickening. And when you have different demographics and with that comes different mindsets, different perspectives, just like we shared about how being Chinese and being in growing up in the South is honoring different perspectives at the same time. The question is, how can we, through the arts, honor different perspectives without force-fitting any of us to be exactly alike? The arts do a great job at that because there's something for everyone in the arts, but not everybody engages in the same ways. So we have this opportunity through theater to be able to be mindful of that and be ahead of the game, ahead and be at the table saying we can lead people by example on how we can honor different perspectives at the same time. Without force-fitting people to. And yet there's a common goal, and through the arts, people experience that.
Definitely.
In such a way.
And you speak a lot about younger generations and moving forward in 2040 and these studies. And do you have any concern with that going forward, with the ongoing trend of schools cutting funding and programming for the arts?
We're always very mindful and attentive to cutting to those projects that are cut off, especially in the arts education area, because we see such powerful ways of the arts to be able for the arts to be able to support kids, and we've seen so many areas not only for kids to experience that experience the arts, but it's tied to stronger academic performance. There's a really good relationship between, especially at-risk youth who have an ability to say this is a way of an avenue of expression that I didn't have over here in this, and there's an ability to retain information longer. So what happens is that it evens the playing field in terms of academic performance, ability to be a contributing citizen, and anytime something like that is cut off, it's more than just the arts. It's an ability for people to grow and learn and be a responsible contributing citizens. So the National Endowment for the Arts is mindful of that and is going in with grants. While the NEA has always supported arts education, especially in the areas of direct grants to projects that support students, but also grants that support professional development of the teachers for the students, we're now going in with grants that pay attention to the whole system. So, for example, if we're able to support much larger grants in the tune of maybe $100,000 or $150,000 over multiple years too, that support, say, a school district that is connected to resources out in the community, everybody gets to contribute to arts education. So we want to help that become much more sustainable, especially in areas that they are tempted to cut.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's amazing. I'm so glad you're doing that work and kind of keeping on the trend of, budgets. The NEA, the Congress is working on the appropriations bills right now. Are you hopeful that maybe over time the NEA's budget might increase?
Well, we are mindful of the current budget conditions. They're very complex, and to date, I believe they are holding steady, both in the House and the Senate, and we're very appreciative of that. Given the budget conditions, as the more we can show through actions as well as communicate that the arts infuse our everyday lives and they apply to so many areas, including the non-arts sectors, the more we can make a case for how powerful the arts are and how our work is meaningful and substantive.
Yes, we're so grateful that they're holding steady on the budget. That's great news. And but discipline programs funding were cut down a few years ago. Can we look to you to restore direct discipline supports for arts organizations?
We're very mindful and want to do that. And as the budget, if it increases, we're absolutely attentive to that.
Yes, that's fantastic. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is there was a study, I think it was about 2 years ago, done by the NEA about theater audience, and it said that the audiences have been declining over the past 30 years. And I was curious what you could do in your role to increase audience engagement with theaters.
this great study that was measuring of 2012 audiences that came out this year in 2015 has great opportunities for all of us who are arts providers, in that the arts are not declining, and attendance is not the only way to measure how people participate in the arts. And in fact, people are participating in the arts in ways that are actually expanding because the arts are thriving. Having said that, we want to make sure that we're paying attention to the ways people participate in the arts, and it is not just measuring only one way. For example, 167 million adults, that's three-quarters of all American adults, participate in the arts. Number one way is through technology. They might view a video, they might create, send. It might not just be a video, it could be the development of images and creativity through technology. And so we want to be mindful of that and find ways for us as arts providers to link to the easiest ways people participate in the arts and not make it a barrier and say it's only just attendance in one area. So, for example, in our discipline of media arts used to be just focused on radio and television. And while we'll still focus on these areas, we have now added digital content as well, because creation through digital content is a really big deal.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the theme of TCG's conference, Game Change, which is about how the game is changing in the theater field, whether it be in diversity or succession or innovations on stage. I'm curious what you, in your role, think people should be putting their focus on in the arts field right now.
The main focus that people can be putting their focus on is related to how we can make the arts meaningful and relevant. And so, as I travel across the country, I'm very impressed with what I've seen, because the arts are thriving and there's so many people making sure that the arts belong to all of us. The ones that are having far more challenges come from a mindset that says, if you build it, they will come. Why can't I just create this one project and everybody will love it? If it is off by itself and we haven't done an opportunity to create a relationship and a meaningful one with our communities, then they will have harder times. So the focus really is on how to connect and link relevancy, connections, communities, the value, the meaning. That's where the focus can be.
That's amazing. And then just a final question, kind of piggybacking off of that, is what are your and the NEA's priorities in serving the theater field right now?
Well, specifically, we are in the process of making sure we have a new director of theater, so we're in that search right now. And we're working specifically in the artworks category to ensure that it's aligned with where theater is really making an impact as well. So there are some very specific tactics that we're focusing on right now to make sure that we can support what theater is doing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Chairman Chu. It's been
a pleasure
chatting with you, and thank you for coming to Cleveland for Game Change.
Thanks for letting me join you.
And we're back to do a little bit of recommendations. Deep, what do you got for us?
Okay, I got two things. One is a play. It's a Kilroy's play that I saw last night from a Club Thumb Theater Company.
How was it?
It was fan-fucking-tastic.
Men on Boats by Jacqueline Backhouse. I'll just give you the title. I talked to Jacqueline for a TDF story. It sounded like fast. From my home state of Arizona.
Yes, and I talked to Jacqueline for a story that I wrote for us. And so the genius of the way she did it was, it was about a river expedition.
Right, 1860s or 80s or something like that.
Yeah, a man named John Powell who led an expedition.
Lake Powell's name for him, yes.
Yep, who led an expedition, and he was like the first group to go through the Grand Canyon and kind of map that entire section out.
Right.
And it's about him and 10 men, but the genius of this is the men in the play are not played by men. They're played by female and trans-identified actors. And so when I talked to Jacqueline about it, she said that it was a way of reclaiming this idea of manifest destiny and how it's usually something that was done by men to other people. And so kind of reclaiming it for a 21st century mindset, for a more diverse mindset. So it was like a group of, you know, African-American actors and white actors and trans
but
actors.
All women and trans.
Yes.
Playing men.
Yes.
But I see what, that's all fascinating, but I was so curious to know how you tell a play about guys on a river raft, a couple river rafts at that space. Like, you
yeah,
know.
It was a lot of really synchronized choreography.
Right, okay.
It's like move left, move right, bank, and they all just move together.
A lot
like,
of water sounds, too.
A lot of water sounds.
Okay,
there's
cool.
The thing I loved, and there's a sign at the box office saying, there's water sounds in this show, so you should go to the bathroom.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I'll try and see that. I really
it's like
it.
Yeah, they just added a performance because it's completely sold out because that space is dinky.
Yeah,
but,
is that the Wild Project?
Yes,
Ben Brantley gave it a rave. That's
yeah, it's a nice space, but it is small. So they sell it very quickly. Like every year, they do summer works, and so. Yeah, good stuff. So keep your eye out for Jacqueline Backhouse.
I think all three of the shows this year got really strong reviews from Ben Brantley, the main critic.
Yeah. And I was surprised he ventured down there.
He does a lot of downtown stuff.
Does,
yeah.
Yes.
So summer is a good time to go to downtown stuff.
Cool.
And
Men on Boats. Look for
Men on
it
boats.
At your local theater.
And please put women.
People on Boats. Yeah.
People on Boats.
People on Boats. Yes, it's like... Lin-Manuel said about Hamilton, if the cast looks like the Founding Fathers, you've done it wrong.
Yeah.
So
if you actually cast men, you've done it wrong.
Exactly.
And the second one is this video that I saw on Jimmy Kimmel. Channing Tatum's doing his press tour for Magic Mike XXL, the sequel to the Steven Soderbergh film Magic Mike about male strippers in Florida. And in the Jimmy Kimmel bit, Jimmy Kimmel had a bunch of elementary school kids write short scenes inspired by the title Magic Mike, and they didn't know what the film was about. So they just had a title go on, and Channing Tatum and Jimmy do a cold read of it, and it was pretty funny.
It's very charming.
It's very charming, yeah. And the kids wrote some... There's like some plot twists and some existential crises. They wrote some very deep scenes for like
eight, 9 year olds. Strippers? No.
No strippers.
No.
Okay.
My favorite one was Magic Mike and his magical bicycle bike.
Magic Mike.
But that
Magic
had the best
Mike.
Twist at the end.
It did. It had a really good twist.
My Magic Mike and this is my magical bicycle pump. And at the end, they're like, "Well, Magic Mike, why is your bicycle pump any better? Like, it's a normal bicycle pump. Why is it magic?" He goes, "Oh, I guess it's just a regular bicycle pump. Guess I'm just regular Mike."
Wow, that's quite a twist.
It was like the future of American theater, people.
Is that a play on the Magic Mike, Magic Bike? Was that the joke or
no?
No,
they didn't.
No,
they just
bang some craft into these kids. Come on.
they didn't resort to some cheap cliches.
I guess not. That's where we thought we were going with Magic Mike and his magic bicycle pump. All right. So, Susie, what do you got for us?
I don't know. I guess I saw a New Brain and Encores Off Center last night, which is
a musical called The New Brain.
A musical called The New Brain by William Finn. And it originally premiered in the 90s at Lincoln Center at the New House off Broadway. It's part of the Off Center series, which is a lesser known Broadway shows that have never been on Broadway that are done during the summer for short concert readings. And I mean, it's a weird show, but some of the music is like in my head to stay. It was really catchy. I've been like listening to the original cast recording on Spotify. The original cast of Kristen Chenoweth, Norm Lewis, Malcolm Getz. Like, really good.
I remember when it was, yeah.
This cast is great. I mean, Anna Gasteyer steals the show. Jonathan Groff is amazing. It's a really good cast. Aaron Lazar is really good.
Can we just see there's a company in, is it San Diego, Diversionary Theater is doing it? So we just put it on Facebook that someone else is doing New Brain. So it's to show that it's a fairly small cast, right?
It's a really small cast, like 6 or 7
sort
people.
Of chamber musical.
It's a chamber musical.
More theaters could do it. It's quirky, it's interesting.
Yeah,
right?
The album's on Spotify if you want to listen to it. It's really good. And I don't know, it closes, I think, on the 27th at New York City Center. So check it out if you can.
Cool. I'm just going to recommend quickly a few. Jackie Lawton's was Diversionary Theater, had that right?
Yes.
It's doing New Brain. Okay, I don't know if it's still
right.
Open, but anyway.
It's not open. It played
all right, just
first,
did it.
21st.
We need more new brains out there in every sense. Jackie Lawton has been curating the blog posts at TCG Circle. A lot of like theater leaders going into the conference, and some of them have been really amazing reads. And I'm just going to shout out to our friend and colleague, Isaac Butler, who had a pretty amazing one that came up after the conference.
Did he go to the conference?
He didn't. But I just recommend it. It's, if you look for Isaac Butler, TCG Circle, he has just a lot of interesting things to say about the challenges facing the field. He's a pretty hard-headed thinker about the notion that art automatically uplifts us all. I mean, there's some real questions about that. But also, what do you do when you know that art is not necessarily the solution for all things, but it's what we do, and what are the best practices for that? So it's a fascinating, searching sort of essay in question form. He did a follow-up to it on his own blog, Parabasis or Parabasis, called Out of Sync, where he talks about the challenge he extracted from all that thinking was that funding models are out of sync with the actual needs of the field. And I think we'll probably explore that more stories in the future. So check those out, Out of Sync at Parabasis and Isaac Butler. And also all the blog posts at TCG Circle about this this blog salon that Jackie Lawton does are really worth looking at.
I just realized something. I said Jimmy Kimmel instead of Jimmy Fallon. I get them mixed up. It's a Jimmy Fallon Magic Mike video.
Hey, that's a big difference. Yeah. We're talking coastal war here, right?
I know, but
talk
show hosts and names. I'm bad with names.
All right. Well, so Jimmy Fallon. Let's make that clear. All right. So on that note, check us out on iTunes. Rate us on iTunes. It helps people find us. Tune in next week.
2 weeks.
Okay, bye.